Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999, dancing on our own to the rhythm of the night here in 2022. I'm one of our hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Felisco.
One of our hosts, one of the hosts. Mm-hmm. With us again, Tom Meissen. Truly a pleasure.
Again. Don't emphasize the again.
The best in the biz. Like that.
Now, with us for the last time, hopefully. Tom Meissen.
But this is an episode we have teased many a time.
Yeah.
So much so, I would say, Kenny, we were so effective in teasing this that when I reached out and texted Tom and said, are you free to come on for Beau Travail? He was like, wait, we're really doing it? Actually doing this movie? I was like,
we're doing it.
We were always intending to do it. It was never a question.
I don't know why it took us so long.
I don't know either.
I assumed you were going to wait until you were just fed up of doing a podcast and then this is the way to just kill it.
I just want to say this. I think that Kenny and I have similar went into this with similar perspectives, in the sense that I knew very little about this movie. I really didn't know what it was about. I knew that it had a lot of love for it. It's been on a lot of sort of 99 lists over the last, you know, decade or
also,
so.
Also like best of the 90s lists. Like, yeah, the people who have seen it and love it.
Yes.
Love.
100%. It is definitely a sight and sound type movie, a movie mm-hmm. that's like on lots of lists like that. All I knew.
I believe IndieWire just had it as number two yes. movie of the 90s.
Of the 90s.
Yeah,
that was the
90s. Yeah, number one was the 99 or two, Eyes Wide Shut. But number two of the whole 90s, they had it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cinema. Do they call it cinema?
I mean, it is
with a capital
cinema.
C.
It's cinema.
This is the most like, this is definitely, Kenny, and I don't want to speak for you, but I think definitely one of the artiest movies of 99.
No, without,
right?
Without question.
And I don't cinema. Say that in a negative way. Yeah. I just mean like, this is full on
this
ballet.
And this and Eyes Wide Shut. Like, it's
first,
not.
I mean, is there
but it's not
20
affected.
Lines of dialogue in this movie?
I counted the 22. It's not affected. You know what I mean?
No, I agree.
It's
I agree.
Like
what's okay? Of you've done most of the films of 99.
85, 90%.
Closest to this of the ones that you've done in terms of arty cinema, capital C cinema.
I think here. So Kenny, you alluded to this the other day when you were texting me about. I think, we, or maybe we've even talked about this on Zoom or something like that. But you know. Girl on the Bridge was a movie that you referred to, also a French film, a beautiful film, definitely a film film, right? Like a movie that's like, we're in black and white and we look really beautiful and it's all about like fate and love and all that kind of stuff.
Vanessa Paradis, love it.
Right, right, right. It's a different
Daniel
animal.
Daniel O'Toole, is that right?
Yeah. It's a different animal because it has a plot.
Yeah. It also feels like it could have been at home.
Yeah, it's like a fucking sellout.
It felt like it could have been at home in you know among 1960s films. Like it doesn't feel that spiritually that far removed from a Breathless, you know?
Yes.
Where like
this is its own animal.
This is very much a 1999 film. You know, like this, like I think the answer to your question, actually it's not a 99 fucking movie, it's a 2009 movie.
Which one?
Hurt Locker.
Oh yeah, I mean, you said, I think you texted me and was like, or said something along the lines of, "What if Hurt Locker ended with a dance to the rhythm of the night?"
And it is extremely similar movies. Yeah.
You know what? I'd say the ending to the Hurt Locker isn't too dissimilar.
It's not.
It isn't.
You mean that? The heavy metal and him just like fucking.
Like you go through the entire film of Hurt Locker.
Yep.
With how tough it is, and it's fucking extreme, and it's intense, and the crippling effect that it has on the people doing it, and it's not the Hollywood, you know, explosions and slow motion doves.
Sure.
And then the very last scene is that.
They're it's not suddenly all that dissimilar.
And then slow motion, and it's the fantasy version of being bomb disposal.
But would you? I do think it's an interesting comparison because I do think that as similar as they might very well be on a certain level, they're also obviously very dissimilar as well. I don't think that this film that we're talking about today is much of a quote unquote indictment of the military industrial complex. Like, I don't really think that this movie is really you do? Okay.
Sure. Of colonialism and also
Yes.
But
certainly
of colonialism, but also of, you know, chain of command. Like, very much like the brainwashing chain of command type thing, and the way these, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Fallible men in this situation have such control over other people's livelihoods and lives.
Yep.
And
yep.
that I think is, you know, and it's and also, you know, like the boondoggle nature of this whole thing. It's absolutely. Like only a military thing, you know, but
I don't mean to suggest that it's not. It is in its own way a condemnation of the military. I do think that it's done in a very a more, I don't want to say emotional, because Hurt Locker is emotional, but that movie is also sort of like aggressively masculine, despite the fact that it is directed by a woman. This film is very tender. Like, this is a very sort of, I mean, at least that's the impression I got about it, despite the fact that at the heart of it is, I guess, a story of revenge or just hatred of oneself or something along those lines. It does feel very sort of, I mean, it's more like visual poetry
I think the indictment of it, sorry to interrupt, Kenny.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
The indictment of military comes in what I consider to be actually the comedy of it.
Sure.
That you watch, and I bet you didn't expect me to talk about it being a comedy, where you get all of these sequences of fucking men at the very peak, and they're physically, they're beautiful because they're strong and they're like Greek statues. They're perfect. They're perfect killing people, and they're doing all their back and forth and their gun exercises, and they're rolling around in the sand and they're fucking intense. And then almost always it cuts away to a local watching them. Just like, what the fuck are you doing? The fuck you and not only that, but what the fuck are you doing here?
Yeah, what the fuck are you doing here? Especially because it's the French Legion. It's just like French Foreign Legion. I agree with you, it is funny. And I think it is too. You know, we'll talk about that in a sec. I think the funniest recurring gag of this movie. Again, this is the funniest movie of 1999, but the funniest recurring gag of this movie is that every single, I don't know what the titles are, but every single private, for the lack of a better title in this, every single underling is like perfect. Like, they're physically perfect, gorgeous Greek gods. And they are, the people commanding them is troll-like Denis Levant. And this, you know,
what a great face. That guy's got a great
best.
And truly, like, in you know, in a vacuum, he's handsome.
Sure,
next
sure.
to these guys, he's a fucking goblin. He's 8 inches shorter than them, and his face has been like, his face has just been pounded over and over with a meat tenderizer. And then I think the guy's name is Michel Suber,
who plays Satan.
Subo, who he's the guy
who plays Forestier.
Yeah, like some, you know, he's just some fat oaf. So you have these.
Listen, what you have to understand is, and this is what I love about France, is the French have sexy ugly or ugly sexy.
Yeah. Yep.
So
I'm on my way there then.
And when you reach a certain age, move to France and you're fucking Adonis.
Yeah, you'll be.
Like, they're sexy. They're the sexy older men. And you have all of these beautiful young physiques.
That's cool.
You know, that's all great. But then
in America,
Denis Levant, sexy.
Yeah, in America, these guys.
Denis Levant is
in
sexy.
Fact, there was an article not that long ago with, you know who I mean? Eddie Marzan. He's an English actor. What was he in? Ray Donovan. He was.
I think I know you're talking about Ray Donovan.
I'm going to look him up.
He's one of the best actors in the world. He's amazing. But he's got a characterful face, and he said,
he's been in Miami Vice.
He's done lots of Mike Lee films.
He's the best.
He's amazing.
He's great.
And he was like, if I lived in France, I'd be a sex symbol. And he's completely right.
It is a very interesting depiction of masculinity, this film, in terms of how beautiful. I mean, the guy, so the young recruit whose name is it Satan?
Yeah, something like that.
Kind of gives off a little bit of an Adam Driver vibe. I don't know if you guys got that. There's something a little bit kind of angular about him that I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
but he's still beautiful,
but also perfect.
So a perfect specimen. There's something also about like the birthday cake kind of like all those moments of just sort of camaraderie and seeing all these just like beautiful specimens being like lovely people on top of everything else, and you're just like, it's a fascinating depiction of war. Let's put it that way.
there's no war. That's the whole point. It's like that I guess is a parable. I don't know if it's true or not, about the platoon on the island that didn't know World War, I think it's a Japanese platoon on an island that didn't know World War II ended, and they were training for 50 years. And that's essentially there's no fucking French Djiboutian war still, if there ever was. Like, what, there's even no peacekeeping operation. Well, I don't even know what it is. They're just fucking chilling and, you know, sleeping with the women.
And dancing. I mean, they go to this dance club a couple times.
Yeah.
There does seem to be a little bit of a fractured narrative going on, too, in terms of kind of jumping around a little bit in time, at least with, is it Galou?
Galou?
How do you say, right? That's how you say his name?
Your Canadian, Phil.
I know.
Whatever, guys. Anyway.
Wait till we do The Hurricane next week. A real Canadian movie.
That is a Canadian movie. I'm looking forward to it. But we're seeing sort of him in sort of past and present a little bit. So we do kind of pop to him post military and how he's grappling with that. And we see him dancing a little bit in that. So, like, I want to just unpack the dancing thing.
Barely grapples. Like, that's not really what's going on. That voiceover. I think the voiceover is him justifying what he did.
That sounds right. I mean, this was one of those movies that, and we've covered a couple of these where I kind of had to just let it wash over me, if that makes any sense. I didn't really want to, because it was clear pretty early on that like this wasn't going to be a plotty movie, and I obviously don't say that with judgment, that this was going to be a mood piece, a whatever you want to call it. So I just kind of let it wash over me, as opposed to like really kind of thinking about it too much. I know that might just not be articulate, but that's kind of, I just kind of let it exist. And in doing that, I didn't feel like it, it felt like temporal. It didn't, it almost didn't feel as though it was in any, like that his character wasn't even locked into any particular time of his life, if that makes any sense, or any particular sort of, I think what you're saying is true, Kenny. I think that that's probably the right take. I guess I just didn't lock into it in that way, which is not to say that it's, you know, wrong.
Yeah.
I don't think
he's regretful, but I, at least consciously, if you were,
you don't think he's regretful, really? Even in that last shot of him holding the gun, which I also don't think is a suicidal thing. I think that's
no, true. I don't no, think
neither
it
do
is
I.
Either.
I think it's like a love a of sex the military. Thing.
Yeah,
I think. Yeah. I think. I mean, you know, we could talk about the final scene.
The greatest scene that's ever been.
Well, it is the greatest scene that's ever been.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it is the greatest scene that ever been. Part of it is because, you know, so God love you if you think you know what's going on in that scene. You know? Like, no, it's like, it's... Yeah,
it, totally.
It's a real Rorschach test, I think. And I really was kind of blown away, and I knew how much I loved it because when they cut to the credits, and I was begging for more, and they gave me,
and then you got it.
I was like, wait, there's got to be more, right?
I was like, that's how I thought. I'm like, there has to be more. You can't leave. And then they came back, so perfect. That was wonderful. Yeah, it was
one more perfect. Bite at the apple. I
also like such great little like that. The weight, I don't even understand. So Claire Denis, obviously, I've never watched any of their other films. I'm a fucking idiot.
And oh, really? Watch White Material.
My friend just told me White Materials is like
which
brilliant.
White Material.
Isabelle Huppert.
It's Isabelle Huppert. It's also set in former French colonial Africa and coffee plantation that she has to abandon, but she refuses to because revolution's coming. It's amazing. She's the best actor in the world.
I've not also seen any of Claire Denis' movies. So this was my entree into her work as well. And I was actually talking with a friend about her and who went to Tisch and was just like, it feels like a film, you know, student thing to just like kind of do deep dives into Claire Denis. Cause like all my friends I've talked to have done this and I feel like an idiot for having not. She's got obviously a lot of movies. This movie was
you
her
can't
sixth.
Watch everything.
No, of course not. This was her sixth. And I would argue that this was kind of a big movie for her. It didn't make much money, but it did feel like this kind of put her on the map a little bit. This movie did not make a lot of money.
What?
I hate to be the one to break it to you. Do you want to guess how much money this movie made, Tom? I'd like to hear your guess.
No. How much was it? What was the budget, first of all?
I could not find the budget anywhere.
I saw $4 million.
Did you really? Okay, so yes. Let's just assume that it's around there. The movie made $570,000.
Yeah. But the thing is,
all from Tom Meissen at the right base.
But the thing is, and I was just talking to my friend Jordan about this. You know, he's like, why do they? I mean, he loved this movie and loves Claire Denis. It's like, I think the comment was, it must be nice to continue to make these movies lose money. And if you look into it a little bit, like this was funded by the French government. Like the French government had a series of films about quote unquote foreign lands, and Claire Denis was like, yeah, sure, I'll do a movie about that. And she, you know, twisted it a little bit and wanted it to be about what's it like to be a foreigner to yourself. And that's kind of the little seed that birthed Beau-Travail.
I think it's interesting that. So High Life comes out a few years ago, right? High Life was the Robert Pattinson, Juliette Binoche movie. Came out in 2018. It was an A24 movie. And I assumed that movie made money. Like, it just felt as though, like, a lot of people were talking about it.
Had a little imprint, yeah.
Had a little bit of impact. I guess it cost around $8 million to make. It made, like, $3 million. And I think, again, it's a movie I want to watch. I've heard it's quite good. I don't know if you've seen it, Tom. Have you seen High Life?
I haven't. No.
She seems like someone that A24 would champion, right? Like it makes sense. And then to see it not perform, you'd have to wonder whether or not, like, maybe they were just like, listen, if the Robert Pattinson Claire Denis movie can't make us money, I'm not really sure what we're going to do. You know what I mean? But to your point, Kenny, I think there's something very specific about her. You know, we haven't talked about this a lot, although I guess we have talked about it a fair amount, but there were a handful of female filmmakers in 99 that actually, you know what I mean?
More than I think people
give credence
realize.
To.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, Virgin Suicides and Boys Don't Cry being probably at the top of the list of two big ones. But
plenty of smaller ones, like Ravenous was directed by a woman, and 200 Cigarettes was directed by a woman, and
Oh yeah,
you know, The Matrix, for instance, sure. And but there are not like a lot,
there's
but
a
there
fair
are
of them.
There are definitely more than 10. I know that feels damning with faint praise, but like there were definitely like, because I remember midway through this, I listed like 6 or 7 that I really loved. So I think there are a bunch. Yeah,
it's interesting that I don't feel like Claire is put on that list as much as she should be, right? Like, she should be in that top five.
Female directors. You're right.
Yes,
I think she kind of is.
Okay.
I mean, there's a Jane Campion movie in 99.
Also true.
What
if her Jane stranger Camp- ones?
But and yes. Jane Campion jumps to mind as another person who, outside of the piano, really never made money with her films from a different country, from a country that supports the arts a little better than our country does, and is now probably considered by most people to be like a top 10 living film director. I think my sense is Claire Denis also is considered to be a top 10 living film director by the people.
The same
who,
circles, I would argue.
The same circles, yes. Yes.
But like you said, second sound. You know?
Yes. Yeah, for sure. I think that, I mean, listen, she has a new film. She has two films coming out this year. So, you know, I'm very curious to see what those are like. I want to give a little bit of context for the people who haven't seen this film, and based on its box office, that's probably a few. Foreign Legion officer Galou, we're going to just call him that, recalls his once glorious life leading troops in the Gulf of, Djibouti? Is that how you say it, Ken?
Djibouti is the country, yeah.
His existence.
Interesting that they say the once. Interesting that they call it glorious. His once glorious life.
Yes, glorious. His existence there was happy, strict, and regimented. But the arrival of a promising young recruit, Satan, plants the seeds of jealousy in his mind. He feels compelled to stop him from coming to the attention of the commandant, whom he admires, but who ignores him. Ultimately, his jealousy leads to the destruction of both Satan and himself. The film screened at the Venice Film Festival for the first time on September 4th, 1999. As I mentioned, it would go on to make a little over $500,000. It is 86% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 77% from audiences. The film was highly acclaimed in the United States. The Chicago Reader rated it a masterpiece. Salon wrote that the film is the most extreme example of Denis' talent, baffling and exhilarating. I don't know when I've seen a film that is so many ways foreign to what draws me to movies and still felt under a spell. Rolling Stone gave it the highest rating, called it unique and unforgettable. And the Village Voice, where the film is so tactile in its cinematography, inventive in its camera placement, and sensuous in its editing, that the purposefully oblique and languid narrative is all but eclipsed. I want to talk for a quick second about, or maybe not for a quick second, but I want to talk about the dancing. And by that, I mean the soldiers, when they're doing these various training exercises that you refer to, Tom, are basically doing dance sequences, right? I mean, this is...
Yeah, they had a choreographer a military advisor working with them.
So it feels as though it's a commentary.
A ballet choreographer.
Right.
But they also had someone in the cast who served in the French Legion, who was, so they were kind of working together. Sure. So these, like, mm-hmm. I think the point that I'm making is these aren't as far removed from what the French Legion actually does as I think may be suggested by the film. I think that this seems pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
I think that all the, queer undertones are just that. I think they're undertones.
I mean, obviously,
there's plenty of stuff that could be read as queer coded, but also just like, you know, that's a function of military life, working with your shirts off and, you know, fighting and that kind of shit.
Sure.
All the Billy Budd stuff is like, if you just dive a little bit into it, just a little bit, you know that, like, all right, now I get the story you're telling from the jump. Sure. And I know what to look out for.
But the Billy Budd stuff you're referring to is that the filmmakers were inspired by a story by Herman Melville called Billy Budd, Sailor, and his poems, The Night March and Gold in the Mountain. I didn't do any diving
Billy,
into that.
There are two things. So there's the short story, Billy Budd. That's essentially this. Mm-hmm. The plot of Billy Budd is about a superior who is, you know, kind of taken with Billy Budd, but also threatened by Billy Budd, and also threatened with his own sexuality, and eventually sends him to his death, I believe. And all the
which Melville didn't finish.
He didn't finish. That's right.
It was released posthumously. Someone else fiddled around with it, and
yeah, it was me. But
I did
the last pass. But the other thing is, all of the orchestral stuff you're hearing and the choral stuff is from an opera called Billy Budd. So it's scored with this idea of it's only one layer deep.
The opera, which the music was Benjamin Britten, and one of the writers of the opera was E.M. Forster, who was he was gay.
Yeah,
he was at a time where you couldn't come
when
out.
When homosexuality was outlawed
in the opera. The opera is even more explicitly gay than the book.
So in Billy Budd,
but still, it's hidden under wraps. So it's getting.
Just out of curiosity, that in Billy Budd, which I know is unfinished, so you know, take it with a grain of salt. But the jealousy that the protagonist feels towards Satan, is that
Billy Budd?
Okay,
that's who Billy Budd is.
Okay, but is that in the story? Is it motivated by desire, or is it just purely jealousy?
No, it's desire and it's self-loathing.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm asking, the only reason I'm asking is because I didn't necessarily feel that Galou was that he had sexual desire towards Satan. Maybe
whether he did towards his superior.
That's interesting.
Yep. That's the question. It becomes clearer. There are a couple of moments where the superior, what's his name? Forestier. Reveals how he feels about Santan. The first is it during the birthday when he mentioned the birthday cake? And he's sitting at the head of the table and Santan's next to him, and just the little flicks of the eye over to Santan, which is just pure dirty, dirty French man. There's an Australian saying for men like that. They're called rock spiders. Call them, he's a fucking old rock spider.
No, that's what they mean when they call me that. I get it.
Just kind of throwing little glances over to him. It's a good one.
I want to kind of underline that for a second, because I do think that this movie is just brimming with shots like that, moments like that, silent moments of just that. Again, you know, picture speaks a thousand words, but there's something about these moments that she captures that make this movie feel so real and so like you're a fly on the wall. It doesn't even feel rehearsed. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, you just feel like what you're watching, there's propped up a camera and these people are just doing what they would have done if there wasn't a camera there, is unreal, really unreal.
The other moment being when Forestier and Santan outside at night having a cigarette.
Yes.
And Santan talks about being found in a stairwell, and Forestier just says, "We're a beautiful find.
Good find. Yeah.
Good find.
It was a good find."
And just walks away. But there's, you know, there's two men smoking cigarettes, and there's something very sexual about the cigarette smoking. And when Santan and Forestier are smoking, it's overly sexual. It's really provocative. Whereas whenever you see Galou smoking, it's like he's got filthy old roll-ups that he's just toying around and he doesn't know what to do with it. And you kind of get the impression, if you're going along with that imagery, you can find the impression that he's not particularly erect functional.
That's incredible.
You're welcome, everyone. Good night. Erect functional with Tom Meissen.
Erect functional. It's a great band.
And you know that, you know, when the girl is asked by her friend whether they're, you know, how they are, how they're about their sex life, whether he's her boyfriend towards the end, and what's it like, he treats me well, and he's there lying on the bed, he can't get an erection, he's not erect functional.
Yeah, he seems like a very...
Whereas then there's this really pert, beautiful young boy, and he and Forestia, he's functional.
Mm-hmm. Well, even taking the erectile function or dysfunction out of the equation for a second, I do think that Glue just seems so pent up and frustrated with himself and really unable to in any way express himself, which is strange. Like, the only expression we really get is in how brutal he is towards his, obviously, to his subservience, and that's just just an expression of what you're talking about, which is, you know,
again,
his attitude in other ways.
Again, why the dance at the end is so incredible,
so good.
Because it's the complete opposite, and it's why Denis Levant is the perfect actor for it. When I was watching it again the other day, and my wife kept walking past and seeing, and there's all these very, you know, Levant with his chest out and very, very solid and can't move. And she just kind of sigh and roll her eyes and move on. And then when it finished, I said, you just have to come and watch the ending. Yeah. And I rewound it and showed her the making the bed and then the dance. And she went, oh, I'd watch that film.
Yeah.
I think that's how Phil and I felt, because we didn't know anything about this movie outside the fact that you liked it. And David Sims loves it.
He does.
But we knew very little about it, right? And then the ending kind of cropped up online a little bit. Like, not even like a big thing. I'm pretty sure it felt like it was just like there was some Twitter thread about great endings, surprising endings, and someone threw it on there. And I think I sent it to you, and I'm like, did you know Beau Travail ends like this?
Yeah.
And then we were just like, we got to see how you get here, you know?
But
fortunately, we knew the ending going into it, but like, still, it really doesn't matter that much, because the whole movie, it does. I mean, Tom, are you up on Better Call Saul? Not that it really matters, but...
Yeah, I've got the finale to watch. I'm all the way up to the finale.
So you get, like, basically, the Better Call Saul has this whole, like, how is this Jimmy going to turn into the Saul we know from Breaking Bad? And there is, like, that doesn't ruin the show, that enhances the show. That's how we watched it. It's how is this guy going to do that dance?
It's I want to say also, it needs to be said that this dance scene that we're all referring to was shot in a single take. They just did it basically once, and it's just fucking brilliant. And there is
worth watching online. I'm going to watch it as soon as this podcast is over.
I've watched it on its own so many times. Countless times.
Joyous. It is so fascinating to watch.
It's very freeing.
I found this out online. I think it's amazing that apparently this was the film that inspired Greta Gerwig to be a director, which I love.
Oh.
I don't see really any connection between her work and this film, but that's neither here nor there. I just think that the takeaway that I think is interesting about that, right, is, and I think we all probably felt this in one way or another watching this film, is that anything is possible. That film is so malleable, and film is so, the potential of it is endless, right? And I think that when you watch films like this, because we're inundated with films that are so shackled to plot and intellectual property and any number of other things, every now and then to see something like this is such a fucking breath of fresh air, because it just makes you feel like, oh, well, Jesus, like, why am I so, like, rigid in the way that I think about film? That's what's so, one of the things that's special about this.
Taking the dance again, two things to say about it, that about the filmmaking process and how you can get magic like this. It was originally, that scene was meant to be earlier in the film. And it was only during editing that she said it has to be the end. It leaves you with so many questions, and it's so beautiful, whether it is even happening or not.
The juxtaposition of the scene in the bed next to this dance scene, it just makes you go,
perfect.
Oh, it's perfect.
But also the brilliance of casting someone like Denis Levant, who... Now, he was, I read somewhere that he had been doing a play in Paris. The shooting was postponed in 98 because of the French presidential election. Okay. And during that time, he was like, I can't hang around and wait for this fucking film to start. So he went and did a play in Paris. Mm. And Claire Denis called him and said, we're ready to go. When do you finish the play? He said, 2 weeks. She said, the day after you come down, you're flying out to Djibouti and we're filming this. So all of the other soldiers had to be doing all of their training and their exercising. He didn't. He was doing some play.
Sure.
And then came out and went straight into being the commander. Now that creates, he could ease an actor as brilliant as him could easily play the commander of them. But it's got to add a layer to it. Mm-hmm. That they've all been together for 2 months training. Exactly. And he just wants in. Also, look at his body, because that's him having not worked out.
Yeah.
I know.
That's just him. He trained, I think, as a clown. And he trained as a clown and a dancer.
I didn't even need to train.
That's what he was known for. But... and she cast him as this rigid, completely upright guy, but then it works for the fluid dance in the desert. It's only pure luck that when you have a scene and you say, okay, now you're in a nightclub on your own and you've got to dance it all out.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I want to know
now, if you directed me and said, Tom, go and stand in the corner and dance it out, it would not be this scene.
What would it be?
What would it be, Tom?
It would be far more elegant. Thank you.
there would be no barrel rolls out of frame.
There's something about...
No, you'd have to... They'd drag me off.
He's not even... I mean, I don't... Our listeners need to just, go on YouTube and watch the clip, because, obviously we're not going to be able to do it justice, but it should be said that it is, he almost seems possessed, right? Like, he seems as though he's just on some other plane of existence.
Yeah.
And it's just, and it's now, unreal.
I'll tell you how I came across this film in 99 or 2000. Mm-hmm. And it was purely because of Denis Levant, who was in the video for Rabbit in Your Headlights by Uncle.
Of course
with
he was.
Tom York. So walking down the tunnel, constantly getting knocked down. And
yes,
again, like that, he's someone who's incredibly physical. He has his amazing face and he was like a man possessed. And I immediately fell in love with him. He's incredible. And so I saw a poster for this and thought, wow, that's that guy from the music video. And wow, fuck, I did not expect this film.
So have you seen Holy Motors? Because I have not. And I know he's in it. And apparently.
Leo's Carax.
Yes. I hear it's brilliant.
I thought about watching that too.
I did too. But it's not.
That and I was going to watch High Life and I didn't. And I wish I had. But particularly Holy Motors, which I've been meaning to watch for 10 years.
Same. Although I will say, I couldn't finish Annette. So maybe they're just not for me. I don't know. I mean,
that's not good. Even with him and Werner Herzog, in the same film.
Annette was one of those films that I hit play and I was like, all right, like, I think I kind of get what I'm let's do this. So just based on film Twitter, Annette, and then I was like, oh, I'm not prepared for this.
Because one of us needs to consider your listeners, guys. In Annette, that's about Michael
singing
Jackson
baby
lookalike who goes to a commune, like an island full of other lookalikes.
No, I think you're thinking of a different film. Or maybe you're not.
Are you thinking of the Joseph Fiennes movie?
I am thinking of a different film. What was that film called? Leo's Carax was in it. And
wasn't it Joseph Fiennes?
No.
That's a different movie.
You're thinking
that was the with Michael Elizabeth Jackson, Taylor. Elizabeth Taylor wrote
yeah. So I don't know what movie you're talking about. It sounds great.
And Danila Bohr, who's the lead in Beau Travail, plays Charlie Chaplin.
What is this movie?
Leo's Carax plays his agent. Werner Herzog is in it. Samantha Morton plays Marilyn Monroe.
Mr. Lonely.
Mr. Lonely.
That's right.
Okay. Annette is Adam Driver, Marion Cotillard. It's a musical by the director of Holy Motors.
Oh my God. Do you know who directed Mr. Lonely?
No.
Harmony Korine.
Of course.
Wow. Of course.
And Diego Luna plays Michael Jackson.
That's right.
I'll watch this movie.
Yeah, that sounds like a ride.
I'm in.
I do think though that Denis Levant has, it's so funny that you, thank you for bringing up Rabbit in Your Headlights, because I was like, I know this fucking guy, and I looked at his filmography and I was like, I haven't seen any of these movies. How do I know this guy? And then you brought it up, the music video, of course, and he's amazing, and everyone should check out that music video. It's Tom York doing the vocals. Who's the band though? Is it
Uncle Twin?
Uncle. He has such a fascinating face, and you can tell that she, by that I mean Claire Denis, is filming him very close. He had a lot of just like really just his face just filling up the screen. And Kenny, you mentioned that his face looks like it's been beaten with a meat mallet. Yeah. And it does.
Yeah. And then hung out in the sun.
It's like pockmarked and stretched, and his eyes are really far apart. But like, you just, he's so watchable. You just want to keep watching.
He's got a great face, and he's got a handsome face in that kind of like alternate kind of way, you know, but he's not these other fucking dudes who are just in the French Legion who are all flawless, which is like crazy.
They don't get as many close-ups though, do they?
They don't.
He and Michel Subor, they get the close-ups.
Yeah.
I want to the training sequence that I couldn't help but sort of, I don't want to say laugh at, but I did find kind of funny.
The hugs?
Now, you know how they came across that? No. You know how they came across that?
No.
The guy who was in the Foreign Legion told them that's an actual thing that they do.
Huh.
That didn't come from the choreographer. That came from the Legion.
It's great. It's great.
It's amazing.
It's great. There's also just like, there's the shots of the soldiers walking on the wires and like crawling on those like high wires, which looked fucking amazing. And then just like, and then it just cuts to a shot of four soldiers just ironing their shirts.
Yeah. They do a lot of domestic tasks, which I'm guessing is very much on purpose. You know, but I think this movie to me, without question, Phil, maybe you have another candidate, is the most like visually gorgeous film we've done. And the way the, you know, kind of the vistas, the topography, the mountains and the waters right next to each other, the color palette, it's like it's really like nothing that I've ever seen. And
it's shot somewhere so bleak as well. So to be able to get something so beautiful out of something so bleak,
it's an incredibly,
it's perfect for the story as well.
It's an incredibly unusual Western portrait of Africa. When you see Africa in Western films, it's almost always, you know, like just poverty beyond belief, or occasionally, you know, beautiful wildlife, but a different like kind of look. Like, has anyone ever kind of Has anyone ever thought of Africa and thought blues? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, it's just not, it's not a color palette, a color tone you associate with Africa, with burnt out sub-Saharan Africa, because that's what we've been sold so many times. Like, I think as someone, and Claire Denis spent most of her childhood in Africa, as someone who grew up there, I think she really did find, or maybe not even find, she really did kind of amplify an Africa she knew and she loved. And it's too bad that it hasn't been more kind of, you know, brought to other people's attention, because it is another face of Africa.
Yeah, I was thinking kind of the same thing. And I've always been interested by people who live near the sea. I've always had British seaside towns ever since I was a kid have made me feel really, really fucking uneasy. There's something about people trying to get as far away from land as possible, and they just can't get any further. And geographically, Djibouti is kind of the same for the French. It's all the way down before the I guess the Sudanese little horn bit. So far from France, so for the very, very far distant bit of French occupied North Africa. And for it to be about people who are trying to escape anything by joining the Legion, and then it's the bit of the Legion that is trying to escape France and then trying to escape land, and they reach sea and can't get any further. I love that she's really emphasizing the sea, especially the first sea close-up that you get is a fucking old tire chucked in it.
Yeah. You know, there's a shot that really stayed with me that speaks to what you guys are talking about, which is you see the regiment are I guess they're digging in some sort of like rock bed that's close to the ocean, and you just see the blue of this ocean and then them just chipping away and the dust.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It was just so arresting, and it's just not an image that I would ever have associated with that geographic, with that, you know, area of the world.
No.
I you know, I'm scrolling right now, Kenny, trying to think of a movie that visually made me think of this film in some way. And this is going to sound like an odd choice, but maybe you'll sort of understand where I'm coming from. I think that The Limey has a similar visual language, taking away subject matter, taking away obviously that one is a crime drama, but like
it does. You're right. I hear you.
There's something about, and Soderbergh has talked about this, about how like that film was essentially found in the editing room, and you sense that he kind of just decided to shatter it into a million pieces and try to come up with imagery that juxtaposed nicely next to each other and spoke. And I do think that obviously they're two very different filmmakers, but that's a film that I thought is a little.
Well, and to Tom's point, that film is geographically pushed out as far as you can possibly be pushed out on this continent.
Yes.
You know, like they're literally, the climax takes place in the water, you know, of that film. Hmm. So, yeah, I think that's a pretty good.
Is that the Terrence Stamp film?
Yes. Oh, have you seen The Limey? Oh, you would love it.
Terrence Stamp, Peter Fonda. Yeah, it's
you
good.
You would love
flick.
It. It's really, really good. It was his follow-up to Out of Sight, and it's really, really, really good.
Right.
But the other thing that I, you know, speaking of images that stayed with me from this film, those salt fields, when Satan has been his compass has been fucked with, he's been just sent out into the world, and he's clearly lost. He knows he's lost. He knows he's probably going to die. And he comes across these, I mean, what are they called? The salt flats. And he lies down in this, it literally looks like, it almost looks like snow, right? Like it almost has this, it's so white. They look like giant snowflakes. Obviously they're not, they're hardened crystals of salt that he's lying in. Just absolutely exquisite. Just a truly oddly beautiful moment when you're like, well, he's gonna die there. Like that just seems like, I mean, there's nowhere else, but I thought it was just
really, and the rock solid shirt that he uses
he uses as a shield from the sun, which is crusted with salt. It's I didn't even know that existed. Kenny, were you aware of the assault flats? Was this something that?
No. Okay. I didn't know.
I was just stunned by it. Just really. I also think it's super fucked up that he fucked up his compass. Like, I don't. It's one thing to say like you're walking back. It's another to be like, oh, and you can't get back.
He was killing him. You know, I mean, that was the whole story. But like,
sure.
One thing I was thinking was, you know, it was an interesting decision to have Santan not die. Right.
Yeah.
He gets picked up by some Djiboutian women who, you know, it seems like they're picking up a dead body. And then we find out that he actually has survived this. And my feeling is like the ending would not have worked if he had died.
I agree.
He would have been too detestable. And like the fact is like it doesn't really change what he did. It's a weird kind of mental gymnastics thing where it's like, okay, so he failed in his pretty good plan to murder this guy, therefore maybe he can be redeemed. But like that is kind of the mental gymnastics I'm playing with.
It seems, yes, it seems that the film is about him and his failure. It's about failure. Typically you join the Foreign Legion because you failed at everything. It used to be known for criminals or people who were chucked out of the army, like Bruno Forestier, the head of command. If you failed, you joined there and you work towards perfection. Well, Galou clearly failed, joined the Legion, worked his way up. If he is erectile, non-functional, he's failing there. He fails in his...
By the way.
I like erectile
dysfunction. Erectile dysfunctional is...
Impotent is not politically correct, thank you.
It's not?
Okay. No, it's erectile non-functional, thank you. he fails there. Yes. He fails in his attempt to kill Santan. He gets shipped back to Paris. He fails as a civilian. And the only thing he's good at is dancing. This is like Billy Elliot.
Billy Elliot's the better dancer.
You should have put that on the poster.
I love his dancing so much. I think it is the best dance sequence in a movie, and I'm a dance boy. I write on a dance show. Like, I live this shit. But I feel, Phil, you were like kind of, no pun, dancing around it a little bit, but it's the way he maintains this internal consistency while not adhering to the rhythm of the song. It is lunacy that it is so watchable. It should be, it's one of those things, much like this film, that shouldn't work and works better than you can even imagine. So I don't know.
There is an element of it, and my reaction to it the first time I saw it was it frightened the living piss out of me, the dance. Having been in clubs similar to that around Europe, particularly around the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
And it's perfect, the little lights and the type of music that it is. And occasionally you would see a late middle-aged man on his own dancing to nothing. And it's terrifying. And when you add to that, you know that this is a man who tried to murder someone. And you know that this is a man who remains physically capable of murdering someone, and he's doing that in the corner, going completely free. You don't know what his freedom is.
Especially considering the image that precedes it is a man essentially embracing a weapon, embracing a pistol.
Yes.
You know, and what I can only assume is the power that comes with it. And, you know, his... You know, the only thing he loves ultimately seems to be the regiment, you know.
Yeah, I think the most terrifying image is just before he takes out the gun, he makes the bed and stands to attention next to it. So even outside of the Legion, he's still got the killers. They're bred to be killers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think Denis Levant said in an interview that... he really understood the character when they were doing the exercise of taking apart and reassembling machine guns. And he said he then realized that machine gun is so perfectly made. You can take it apart, put it back together without needing to remove screws, anything. It's perfect. And it has one job, which is to kill. And it's perfect for that. And that's exactly what the Legionnaires are. They're created to be perfect killers. And so when you see him in the civilian world, the first time you see him there, he's up a tree with a fucking great machete hacking away at the natural world. And then the last time you see him, he's still saluting like a legionnaire. You don't know what his freedom is. And so to see him completely let go in a club, it's terrifying.
Also, there's something, and, you know, not to get too, you know, whatever about it, but there's also something about the final shot before we see him dancing is actually the sort of intersection of his arm and this twitching within his arm that feels very biological, that feels very much sort of like this hardwired beat inside him that then transitions pretty beautifully into Rhythm of the Night. But I just think that there's it's a perfect thing, but there's something about the visceral kind of just under the skin. There's something, you know, just pulsating within him, you know, that in and of itself is such an arresting image, and you can obviously read into it however you want. I'm sure it means something to Claire Denis, you know, but yeah, it's just, there was something about the way the camera just kind of like gracefully lands on this part of his arm. It's haunting.
Yeah. What luck to find that. Amazing. Right?
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, so. But also equally, if I know lots of people do like to, try and put as much homoeroticism and reading into it. Well, perhaps then that's the what's beating inside of him. You get the very homoerotic image of him holding a gun and where he's holding it and how he's holding it. And then to what's actually beating inside of him, and it's the freedom in the gayest club, him dressed in the gayest clothes, dancing to the gayest song. The only thing I texted to Phil after watching it for the third time in the last fortnight, last night, was...
You texted me... Rhythm of the Night is a fucking banger. I love that song.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. I felt the same way. Great. I was singing it for the next 3 days.
It's a great song.
It's very good.
It's great. I mean, there's something also just, and to kind of go back to what you were saying at the beginning, and I know that you were being kind of joking about, you know, this being a comedy, and I don't think that this movie is necessarily a comedy in the strictest sense of the word, but for this movie to end on such a playful note, for this movie to end on, or at least a playful song, or, you know what I mean? On the surface, you're watching something very joyous, very fun. Now, obviously juxtaposed to everything that's preceded it in the 90 minutes, you have to question whether or not she's taken the piss out of everything that she's done before, or if we're witnessing some sort of a rebirth of this man in some way or another. I mean, you can kind of take it any way that you want, but it certainly ends on an upbeat, at least the impression of that.
And begins on an upbeat. It begins in the same club with that kiss, kiss song.
Great song.
But it starts with the girl.
Yes.
Yeah. Singing, I love that. That was
seeing
great.
Galou also in the dance club with his girlfriend, or however we want to refer to her, dancing with her, and the look on his face as he's dancing is very sort of, you know, very sexual. It seems like he's trying, you know what I mean? He's really kind of trying to put on, there's a bit of bravado to it. So when you put that next to whatever the fuck he's doing at the end of this movie, which is is also kind of great too. Like there is something about him exuding there's something performative almost about the way he's dancing with that girl in the club, just sort of, you know what I mean? The ownership of it and the sort of, you know, the masculinity of it. And then at the end to see him dancing with just, you know,
reckless abandon.
Reckless abandon is the perfect way to put it. Yeah. I think it's interesting. He's alone, which I think is also interesting. You know, for whatever reason, I just talking about what you were talking about earlier, Kenny, about how we'd sort of, there was a clip that was floating around of this dancing. For whatever reason, I thought it was a group dance scene. And now I'm realizing that it was the mirrors and that it seemed like there were more people there. But again, like, not to get too pseudo intellectual, but like, he is surrounded by mirrors. He's surrounded by reflection. Mm-hmm. You know,
pseudo, that's actual intellectual. Nothing pseudo about that analysis.
But, you know, I think that that also says something too.
For sure.
I will say though, the camera angle of him dancing is a wide shot, right? Because they clearly don't know what the fuck he's gonna do. So the camera, when it's trying to follow him, there is an uneasiness of the camera being like, where's he going next? What's he gonna do? Which I think is fucking great.
It is.
It's really amazing. There were two other things I wanted to talk about. Speaking of just beautiful photography, the underwater sequence with the knives, when they're swimming underwater with the knives, and like the dirty kind of the dirt in the water and the film grain and this sort of like really sort of oddly ethereal kind of imagery, just really.
Yeah. And also just the fact that they kept the dirty lens on it. Yep. That's, there must be a reason for that, that I'm sure film students would love to dive into.
The answer being, of course, that they probably were like, oh, fuck, the lens is dirty.
It's too late. It's lunch, everyone. It's too late.
The other scene I wanted to talk about was the chess scene with Fortier.
Ah, now, in my notes, having not written anything for quite some time, suddenly I get sexy chess. And that's all I wrote about that.
It is sexy chess, though.
It's very sexy.
Well, first of all, you know, it's a trope to some degree to have people play chess, because it does feel like, you know what I mean? In the history of cinema, it feels as though whenever you want to show that two people are in a battle of wits, they're going to fucking play chess. Like, it just feels like that's the thing.
Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, exactly.
We all know.
We all know. And yet this turns out on its head, right? Like, they're not trying to, I don't really feel like they're outwitting each other. I think that if anything, it's kind of on its face as to what they're doing here, but maybe I'm being, you know, glib. But
that's also with his erectile non-functional cigarette rolling.
Yeah.
That is the scene of his non-erectile dysfunctional. Yeah.
All I want to do is watch the dance sequence and smoke a cigarette right now just to prove I can.
You have to wear also, that costume, I mean, as well.
The other thing that I noticed too, and I guess with a film like this,
just a black button down and the black pants
with the chain and those shoes.
Not that gay. Beautiful. I don't know.
I'll say this.
Yeah, I think it just looks good.
But no, the sexy chess.
Yeah,
they are so close together.
They are,
and they're in command. They don't really do the down and dirty and roughing up with each other.
Correct.
With the other soldiers. So for them to suddenly, there are bigger tables that they could sit at.
Yeah.
They choose to sit at the tables really close. And the whereas all of the young, beautiful, sexy Greek gods can, you know, flash their bodies at each other and, you know, bump into each other.
Sure.
They have to do it with chess pieces. And they ram their little chess. It's waving their little willies at each other.
There's also, I mean, part of it too is there's a line, and forgive me, I don't remember it verbatim, but where he's like, where Fortier is essentially saying like, oh, you're really going to make me work for this, right? Like, he's not taking it easy on him. And that idea of Galoo actually, you know, trying to beat his superior in this situation, I think is also emblematic of their dynamic, right? In terms of what Galoo wants to think of him as a peer, as opposed to a subordinate, I think is an interesting thing there. I also feel like with a movie that has this little dialogue, or at least like lines of dialogue of people saying things to one another, as opposed to the VO, that you really tend to focus on the visuals, right? And there's something about Galoo's hands, they're so dirty, they're just absolutely filled with grime, and the idea that he's like licking this fucking cigarette with his fingers all like grimy and disgusting, like, it's just all of that stuff just feels like it adds so much to his character.
Yeah, well, that's just French people.
I mean, when he's right, guys.
Yeah. No, man, I can't wait to talk about Canadians on the Hurricane.
I genuinely have no idea. I've never seen the Hurricane, so I don't remember.
Oh, it's a deeply interesting movie about Canada.
Is it?
Yes. Wait till you hear my take on it. But let's,
yeah, we can rate this.
You want to rate this, baby?
You go first.
Me?
Yeah, you.
I mean, it's always disappointing when you feel like you can't really go up. But I was, I was at a 96, and I am, you know, I am erectile non-functional when it comes to going up any further. I don't know if I can go any further than, and it's a little hard for me to go any further than 96.
Were you attempting a pun then?
He did. No, I think he was pretty successful at it, quite frankly.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
I will.
Are you saying it was a boner?
We don't hear the word boner enough.
Boner.
Fact.
All right.
Would he try another?
96 before, 96 now. One of the finest movies we've seen all year. Strong contender for my top 10 list. Strong contender for end of the year plaudits. Just an incredible movie experience. I had a feeling it would be really good, I had a feeling I would really love it. Anyway, so unfortunately, it doesn't have kind of the surprise factor of A Girl on the Bridge or Last Night, but really, it's just a brilliant, beautiful film.
Mr. Meissen?
No,
what
please.
Were you when you saw it? Like, what was your grade when you saw it? You know, in 99 or 2000, and where are you now?
First time. Yeah. Not quite as high as now. It was my introduction into capital C cinema. But then to revisit it now, it was in the mid to high 90s.
Do you think that it, like, when you saw it at whatever age you were at, I'm assuming you were a teenager when you saw it.
Late teens.
Did it kind of crack open your head a little bit in terms of like what you were like, oh, wait, we can do this?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. What, 6 months earlier, I went to see The Phantom Menace, and then, then I'm watching this. And that's the great thing about movies, is that you can have these two films, Phantom Menace and this, in the same year.
This movie has a real lack of Jar Jar in it.
Yeah. Jar Jar doing that dance at the end.
Again, it's too bad the movie wasn't bigger, because we could have gotten so many dance parodies. But
I know. It's true.
But now it's as close to 100 as you're going to get from this year for me. I love it.
So I didn't see this in 99. This was the first time I saw this film. I have not seen any Claire Denis films, but I will rectify that immediately after having seen this film. I came into this podcast at an 88. I very much liked it. I'm at a 92 now. I mean, it's a very, very, very good movie. Movies like this are always a little bit tricky for me on a certain level, because I feel like really powerful, really important capital C cinema art, all that kind of stuff, is always sort of challenging in its own way, right? So you're sort of, it does feel like you got to kind of get yourself into that headspace. So I don't know that it's a film that I'm necessarily, someone like you, Tom, going to watch three times in a couple of weeks, but I do feel like,
I think this is a highly rewatchable movie, though, in a way that other movies we've done aren't. Okay. Like, I thought about rewatching it this week.
Oh, wow.
Especially because, like, the end recontextualizes the rest of it. So. Yes.
And this isn't something that I think we'll necessarily be able to pull off the top of our heads right now, and something that I think when we wrap up our 99 podcast in the months to come, I do think I'd love for us to talk about like best last scenes, because I do feel like this is without a doubt one of the best, if not the best, final scene. Like, there are final lines. I think we've talked about, you know, obviously Eyes Wide Shut is a great final scene. Like, there's lots of great final scenes in 99, but this one, it just feels next level. Like, it's
sure
unreal. So next week, The Hurricane, Kenny, with your friend Christian
Pierce.
We're going to be talking about the Denzel Washington Norman Jewison movie. They notoriously almost made Malcolm X together. And then Spike Lee said, I don't think so. And Norman Jewison walked away.
He said, so. Not smart, Norman. So go find another, go find another black man.
And then they did this movie.
Norman, all right. So a little preview of my take on this film is I find Norman Jewison's like career long obsession with race relations in America to be extremely fascinating, considering he's a white Canadian.
Not a Jewish son.
A white Canadian who in some ways benefits from American racism and probably does not feel in any way he is responsible for American racism. And I think that The Hurricane is a really interesting, and it's interesting in a lot of ways, but a really interesting kind of story about American racism explicitly from the point of a Canadian person. So I think it's really interesting in that way.
It's
almost autobiographical.
We've talked about doing this film for a very long time. I'm glad that we're finally doing it. I'm interested to talk about Jewison. I think, you know, In the Heat of the Night being obviously one of those films that was a huge sort of tip of the spear film. Obviously for Sidney Poitier's career, but for, you know, just what have you. But yeah, I'm excited to talk about it. Have you seen The Hurricane, Tom? Do you know of The Hurricane?
A long time ago.
Right.
Norman Jewison also did Lean on Me, right, Phil? So that's...
Lean on Me? No.
No?
No.
No, he did not. Who didn't Lean on Me?
That I couldn't tell you off the top
of
my head.
Some other whitey
decided to do it.
Oh my god, he's so interesting, dude.
He's a fascinating filmmaker. He's one of those guys you're just like, you did this?
So okay. He's not a Jew. He did Fiddler on the Roof.
Arguably the most Jewish thing that's ever been.
He did Jesus Christ Superstar.
Well, the one in the desert?
The one in the desert, yes.
Wow.
Yes.
I love that film.
If we can silo out that audio clip too, that'd be great.
he does Moonstruck in 87, but he had
Moonstruck
really,
a masterpiece.
Yeah. He really kind of fallen off. But in 99, he kind of gets this chance to do this. Well, because he
was trying to do Malcolm X for a long time. Like that was a real uphill climb for him.
Yeah.
Understandably.
We'll talk more about Jewison.
We'll talk more about Denzel. This will be our second Denzel of 99. Our first being obviously the bone collector. everyone's favorite collector. If you've seen Bone Collector, Tom, I feel like that's a movie you probably saw
a long time ago.
Yeah, that movie was a hit. I feel like everyone saw
the least Denzel movie like ever. Yeah. I really liked the movie, I'd forgotten it was him.
Yeah,
Denzel movie in a bed.
I mean, this is the thing about Denzel, which is like I'll basically watch him in anything. Like I mean, I don't know, right?
The Hurricane is a very Denzel-y Denzel.
Can't wait.
Yes.
Tom, you know, a pleasure as always. We love having you on.
I can't believe you actually did this.
We did it.
Of course we did.
We knew we would.
It was only a matter of time, really. But I mean, listen.
Didn't we kind of bend the rules a little bit for this one?
No.
A little bit.
In terms of its release?
Its American release was 2000.
Yeah, but then so was Virgin Suicides.
Virgin Suicides is an American film. There were, but whatever.
Okay.
Yeah, idea was an American film, world release. World cinema, American release. Because we were trying to like fit in a lot of stuff, and then this doesn't fall into it. You know, like world cinema, that's how you get like Princess Mononoke, you know?
Right.
So Mononoke, which is like it's 97 in Japan and 99 here. So we were trying to fit in a lot of shit, but like we, you know.
I mean, it did have its North American premiere in 99 at TIFF shortly after.
Then it counts.
That's what I'm saying. So we're good.
Guys, sorry. It counts.
You need rules. This is amateur hour.
We follow the rules. If it premiered, world premiere at TIFF, then we're good.
So as we finish this podcast, and as we wrap up our 99 and our 2000 at the end of this year, Tom, we can't wait to have you back for whatever the podcast turns into, whatever we decide our next podcast is going to be. We can't wait to have you on for that.
I'll be there.
And it's going to be glorious, whatever that is. I truly, at this stage, Kenny and I have no idea what that is, but it's going to be great. We can promise people a good time. Talking movies in some form. Thank you again, Tom. This was, I'm honestly kind of perfect final 99 film from Tom Meissen. Couldn't have asked for a better one.
It started with Cruel Intentions.
Your list is hilarious.
Your list is amazing, Tom.
Watchmen, Die Another Day, or whichever one we did.
License to Kill.
Wizard.
The Wizard.
That was a good flick. That's the second best movie you've done.
Sleepy Hollow, obviously.
Sleepy Hollow.
We talked Bjork. Just Tom and I talking.
I can't believe you did Wizard. You're a wild man.
That was my only request. When 89, I want Wizard.
Good.
I was like, do you want to come on for Bond as well? He's like, yeah, that's a weird Bond movie, but I need to come on for The Wizard. I was okay. All right. A glorious person. This was great.
Thank you so much,
Tom.
I love you guys. Thank you. Right.
Tom, meeting you has been the best part of this podcast for me.
Thank you so much. This was an absolute blast.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was nice meeting you too, Kenny. Sorry.
Thank you.
Talk to you later.
Bye. Bye, guys.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.